Thank you very much. I didn't run them consecutively. that's over a period of about 25 years, so it's not necessarily as impressive as it might sound. Thank you very much again for the kind introduction, and also to Paul for setting the scene so well on what energy security means. It just means I don't have to spend a lot of time doing that, because I think that did that rather well. But I would just highlight something Paul started with, that definition from the International Energy Agency of not only the availability of energy, but the price of energy. Those two things really, really matter. And Paul emphasized it, and I'd emphasize it too. So if you think about the crisis we're currently in and the way in which Britain and British consumers have actually experienced the consequences of Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, it hasn't been through disruptions of our energy supply, although there have been fears of that. You know, we haven't seen lights go out and the gas stop flowing, but what we've definitely seen is a disruption in terms of prices. And our bills now have been on average 2 to 3 times higher than they were 2 to 3 years ago. So that price security is really, really important and has been a massive problem for many households. So I wanted to start by going back quite a long time, 110 years. It's fascinating the number of papers and books that quote this line from Winston Churchill. I'll explain why it's important in a minute, but I'll just leave you to read and think about it. This came at the time when, well before Churchill was a wartime leader in the Second World War, it was actually before the First World War, where he was in charge of the British Navy, and he oversaw the switch of ships from coal to oil. And at the time, the UK was not an oil producer, it is now, and so he was tasked with, well, where am I going to get the oil from? And he saw quite an important lesson for energy security generally, and it's still just as important today, and it will be important for the next many decades as we transition to net zero and beyond, is that you shouldn't rely on one source and one supply route for a very critical fuel that is powering part of your economy, or in this case, part of the British Armed Forces. So I'll return to that in a moment. But I wanted, in terms of framing, just to add to what Paul has set out. You know, he set out very well the different dimensions of security, that it has economic components, sustainability components. It's both short and long term. Just an observation about the current debate in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine is that many countries around the world, and the UK included, there's been this tendency to say, well, the problem was in other countries, you know, not too far away for us, but even in the US, they would say, well, the problem is outside. So what we should do is reshore as much of our energy system as possible. We should have national homegrown energy. And you can see the government ministers, but also opposition spokespeople using that same language to describe the goal. We should have more British-made energy. I think the thing I just want to just emphasize for you to bear in mind is when you say that, it's much easier said than done, because we are very, very plugged into an international world. It's kind of an echo of something that was said in the previous session before lunch. Trade happens, and it happens because different countries have different resources. So actually becoming energy independent or having a national energy system in the UK is not possible at the moment. We don't produce enough oil and gas to meet our own demand, so we already have imports coming in. And as you transition to low carbon sources, we're not going to be able to own and manufacture and source the materials for all of the technologies and storage technologies, et cetera, that we're going to need. So actually, any energy security vision and definition is going to have to take into account the fact that we are interconnected with other countries. So hence the putting Churchill up here is we're still going to have to think about how we source, whether it's fuels, whether it's technologies, or whether it's materials, as we go through this transition to net zero from other countries, and to think about the diversity of those supply routes and how they get here. So since Russia invaded Ukraine, like many countries and regions, the UK government has brought out a strategy for energy security. In fact, two versions of the strategy have come out, one last year and one this year, which was a sort of update, more of a plan. And the rest of my talk, I'm going to base on a briefing that myself and one of the fellows, Kathy Page, who's here, published last week, which is really building on those strategies because it kind of highlights what we think of some of the deficiencies in the current government strategies, apologies, Paul, and things we think should be a features of even a new improved strategy. So when the third version comes out, these are the things we'd like to see emphasized more. So I thought rather than just talk about energy security in the abstract, this would be a good way of talking about what some of the real specific issues are, and very much complementary to some of the things Paul talked about. So the first one really picks up on this point about it being a systems issue. So when people think about and talk about energy security and write strategies, the temptation is always to talk about energy supply. How do we get more supplies or new supplies or different supplies of fossil fuels? How do we develop the technologies to supply low carbon electricity or low carbon hydrogen or whatever it happens to be? This is where we started, and many other people start, so this isn't a novel point, is that demand matters too. So this is a graph from the Committee on Climate Change, the government's official advisors who monitor the carbon budgets that, that Paul was talking about. And this is just a graph of the number of measures they think are needed, will need to be put in place to meet the next carbon budget over the next few years in terms of things like loft insulation and so on. So it's thinking about investment in people's homes. And that will not only help energy security by reducing the amount of fuel, whether it's renewable or not, we use, but also bring people's bills down, hopefully make people's homes better and improve their health and so on. But that has to ramp up incredibly fast. And so one thing we put in our first recommendation is to really reverse the trend. At the moment, we spend some money, government spends some money on helping poorer households insulate their homes. That's really welcome. But compared to what we were doing 10 years ago, those programs are quite small. So we need to see that ramp back up again. So it's about insulating homes for all the reasons I just mentioned. So that's our first one. The second one goes back to the price security point. So in the meantime, this graph I showed you just before, that is not going to happen overnight. Even with the Committee on Climate Change, a very ambitious schedule for rolling out insulation and really scaling that up and all the skilled people you're going to need to do it. So in the meantime, and maybe beyond that, we need to think about, well, how do you help people with their bills? So bills aren't going down. They're still at twice the level they were 2 to 3 years ago, which was a steady state for many years of around £1,000 a year across gas and electricity. They're now around 2,000. So for many homes, that's still unaffordable. And although all the subsidies we all got have all disappeared, there's a need to keep helping people on lower incomes. So one idea which has been circulating again as a result of this is the idea of a social tariff. Some of our colleagues came up with a particular version of a proposal saying, well, maybe a 30% discount for those households that are spending more than 10% of their income on fuel. Which captures quite a few households, as it says here, around, it doesn't say, oh, it does, 6 million households. That would give them a hefty discount. It wouldn't make the bills completely affordable, but it would make quite a big difference to them. So that's, again, thinking about the demand side, but thinking about the price security. So it's only when we get to our recommendation number 3 of 5 that we start thinking about supply. Now, supply, the UK is starting to do reasonably well over the last few years. We've been very, very quick in the last few years at deploying some of the cheapest renewable energy sources, and that was shown in the graph that Paul showed earlier on. So particularly on offshore wind, but also solar, some onshore wind, those have been rolled out quite rapidly. We did have a hiccup a couple of weeks ago when an auction was held for contracts for the next wave of offshore wind farms, and no firms bid because the price on offer was too low. And like all industries, they'd suffered from a lot of price and cost inflation. Luckily, I think, the government has realised that this was not a good idea, and they're actually proposing to increase the amount of money available in the next auction so that we can continue to capitalise on that that real success track record. So the message we've got here is let's continue to do the things that we're doing well at, the things that are actually low cost, do what we can to mean that consumers can get access to the benefits through those low costs, because at the moment the market design means that gas sets the price. So the price we pay is set by gas. It's not set by the price of an offshore wind farm. That is clearly wrong in the low carbon age and needs to be fixed. But also there's a need to work on things like deploying storage and so on. And Paul has talked about that before. Once you've done that, then it's much easier to decarbonize heating and transport and all the other things. So that's our third one. The corollary of this is something I think government likes to talk about less, and I think it's something that government and industry really need to engage with a bit more seriously, which is we are a fossil fuel producer in the UK, but we are a declining fossil fuel producer. Coal mining is almost non-existent. Oil and gas production is declining rapidly. This is what the government's own regulator, the North Sea Transition Authority, thinks is the outlook, even with some new fields coming on stream in the yellow and red there. So it's a decline. You can argue about whether the slope is right. Should it be shallower? Should it be steeper? But it's a declining industry. That has several consequences. One is that the upstream industry and the jobs within it, we need to think about, well, where are these people going to go? Connecting again to the previous session, what are the retraining needs, etc. But also, there are consequences for people downstream. So all the people that will come in and put in a gas boiler or hopefully a heat pump in your home, well, a lot of them are going to need to be retrained too, so that they have a job that's resilient to this low-carbon future. The third thing we think is important is the network infrastructures that are connected to this, particularly the gas network. There's still a debate about this, but I think most people now expect most homes to be heated through electricity in the end. Some may go to hydrogen and low carbon gases, but most will go to electricity. Now imagine what's going to happen if half the population have moved to electric heat pumps, but we still have the same gas network sitting there all over the country. It used to, well, it currently serves around 21 million homes, maybe 23 million. At some point in 10 years, 15 years' time, maybe that's down to 10 million or even less. All these people that are still on gas are then going to have to pay for the maintenance and the operation of that network. Yeah. Is that a sustainable business model? Probably not. So there really has to be some thinking about how we decline and transition away from an infrastructure while still paying for it, so it's still reliable for those people who are still using it. And I think that's something that hasn't been done enough. And then my final point is thinking about the risks of transition and the risks of where we are going to end up as well. So clearly there's opportunities and challenges, as Paul said, but there are a number of new risks which are really coming to the fore. Many of them have come to the fore already. So one is cybersecurity. So as we electrify everything and we digitalize everything, there is potentially more vulnerability to cyber attack. Grids have been attacked electronically in that way, not least Ukraine's grid several times, but suspectedly by Russia in the run-up to the invasion. That has happened already, so this is a really, really important thing to build into the new grids, as to how to make them resilient to that. New infrastructure is being put in place to connect us more and more to other countries, which is a good thing. That helps to share security and to help share that resilience, that diversity point that Winston Churchill talked about. But at the same time, if you've got very large cables going from the UK to other continents, as is proposed here in this Financial Times headline, we've got to make sure that those things are protected, because if they were to be blown up and there isn't sufficient resilience in the system, that could be a serious problem for the UK's electricity supply. And then finally, something which is talked about quite a lot is materials. I mentioned it in passing earlier. So the materials that go into a lot of the low carbon technologies are also geographically concentrated, not necessarily in their mining, but in their processing. So as you'll see here, this is the International Energy Agency's snapshot. On the right-hand side is the processing of many of these minerals that go into these technologies. And you can see in red there, there's a real focus on China. So China has made a very strategic move over the last 10 years or more to get into the processing and the mining of these minerals, to own mining in other countries and so on. That might have security consequences now and into the future. So just as we have to worry about the diversity of oil and gas now, we should worry about the diversity of these minerals and the technologies they go into in future. I'll leave it there. Thank you.